You are listening to the INCJ podcast, Conversations about International Criminal Justice. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the INCJ International Seminar. And we need just to use this first few minutes to explain what's happening. What you can see in front of you is a roundtable seminar, which is probably going to fill up a little bit more. But out there live on YouTube are about 106 people. Now, I don't know whether this makes any sense to you, but I guess the best way of imagining it, this is that there's 106 people in a lecture theatre spread over about 25 countries listening to a seminar. So I just want to say a really big welcome. And I'm hoping that this is going to be a lively, interesting, and also useful event. We're going to use the first couple of minutes leading up to 2 o'clock European time just to explain how the event's going to work. It's the first time we've done this at INCJ, which is to run a live YouTube and a live Zoom at the same time. Now, the reason for that is that we can get two things happening. We can record a YouTube and we can record a Zoom from which we can make a podcast and also a YouTube. But it means that you can ask questions if you use the chat facility. And our editor will pass those questions to us, and hopefully we can put that to our expert panel, which is sitting around the round table. So that's the theory. We really hope we can make it work. But I guess, as with any live event, things can go wrong. Actually, if it's live, things going wrong probably makes it more interesting. And my understanding of it is the best thing that can happen is if a child wanders in. I'm rather hoping that my son's dog won't start barking, but maybe if that happens, it'll be more memorable as a result. But as we get closer to the start time, I'm really hoping that this goes well. We think we've got a very interesting program, and we hope that you will find it useful for your work or for your studies. And we're getting close to the witching hour. And as we get to 1 o'clock UK time or 2 o'clock European time, we'll start then. Thank you very much indeed. Right, my name's John Scott, and I'm here representing the International Network for Criminal Justice, which is based at De Montfort University in Leicester in the United Kingdom. And we're hosting an international virtual seminar today on digitization and human rights in prisons. If you want to find us on the internet, we're at criminaljusticenetwork.net. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, it's at INTCJNetwork. Now, today is the first of six events in our 2021 program. And we've brought together a panel of experts and practitioners to discuss how digital tech change in prisons, which has really accelerated during 2020, and where it's going to take us in the coming year. We're going to be looking at the policy and practice challenge that's being faced by criminal justice, both advocates, managers, and policymakers across Europe, and where that's going to take us. We've got presentations today from Rubicon, that's an NGO in the Czech Republic, from Stephen van der Steen, who's from France, and Victoria Knight from the United Kingdom. And what's really good is that we've got somebody who's had lived experience as someone who's served a prison sentence called John Costa, and somebody who from the Czech prison service who can give the public sector perspective. Now, we've got quite a dense program, so my job is to keep things moving, and I'm hoping that you'll find it useful. Again, we'll get comments from members of the roundtable, but also hopefully give you a chance to send questions, and which we will put to the members of the panel. The issues that we want to cover are not just about technology, but some of the ethics and values that are raised about control and security as communication tools are developed in prison settings around the world. And these can have a real impact on prisoners and staff as they understand how to use the digital agenda. And there are real practice implications of online interviews, not just for the staff based in prisons, but for families, maybe for victims and for probation staff and for other professionals that have to access people in prisons. Now, if you're interrupted today and can't listen to the whole broadcast, as I've said, you'll be able to catch it later if you're called away or homeschooling or something like that intrudes. Well, thank you very much for coming. And we're going to start with an overview of the subject by Victoria Knight, who's an associate professor at De Montfort University based in the UK. So I'm going to hand over the floor to you, Victoria. Please take it away.
Thank you, John. I'm just going to share a screen. Thanks so much, everybody, for attending today. I'm absolutely delighted to see the amount of people that this has attracted. What I want to do is, John said to me, could you give a global overview of the sort of prevalence of digital technologies in prisons? And I sort of scratched my head and said, I can't possibly do that in 5 minutes. So what I've done is I've created a sort of visual taster of some of the things that I've come across during my time as a researcher on this topic. And as you can see, like in the outside world, there's a variety of technologies appearing in our prisons. It's impossible for me to give an idea of the kind of volume of technologies in our prisons, but there are several things that I do want to say. The first is the digital revolution is happening in our prison services across the globe. It is happening. There are variations, obviously, across the globe, but even within single jurisdictions. I've often described it as a postcode lottery. So if you're a serving prisoner, depending on which prison you go to, will depend on the kind of access to sort of digital services that you may have. This also includes sort of stuff for staff. But what I find interesting as a sociologist is the impact that this technology has on the human end of things. So what is it doing to the people and the structures within prisons? And I've been really lucky enough, I think, at the beginning to sort of enter this field of study right at the beginning of digitization and that process. So I've just given you a taster there of visuals, and I apologise if I've stolen some of these images from lovely people that I've met along the way, and you'll recognise, I think, your own products. Some of you are here today. I've also been lucky to do is to work closely with practitioners to kind of look at and interrogate, you know, an understanding of the prison digitization program. And I've worked very closely over the years, and you'll meet Stephen in a minute, Stephen van der Steen, and he's been really helpful in bringing, I suppose, that practice focus, what that landscape's like and how certain decisions are made. And I think one of our most recent publications, and there's a list on our PowerPoint which we can make available to you guys, is one of our publications, and I think that's the theme of our discussion, around, you know, what happens to the prison environment if we introduce tablets, kiosks, laptop setups, electronic monitoring. You can see in the centre of the screen there a robot guard. What's going to happen to the prison, and should it disrupt the prison system? Should it make it more punitive, or should it make it more rehabilitative? Stephen and I have been reflecting on this, and we're going to talk more about that in a moment. So I think I'm at the position at the moment that whatever technology is introduced, something as simple as an in-cell telephone, for example, can change the way in which people think, behave and feel and respond to the prison environment. So in terms terms of a global overview, Stephen and I and Bianca Reisdorf are currently doing a global study exploring what we're calling digital maturity. And we're looking at different jurisdictions and where they're at on their digital journeys. And so we're in the midst of that study at the moment, and it's revealing some really interesting results in terms of the decision making that those responsible for change and digitization, what are they deciding to implement it, and what the investment's like, where are they starting, what's driving that decision making. And what we're finding is that the outside world is having an influence on that. So how digitized our societies are, wherever we are, in whatever jurisdictions, is influencing those decisions to move things along in the prison system. But we're reporting on that later in the year. So that's a global overview. I've kind of bailed out of that a little bit, and I want to hand over to Stephen now, and we're going to talk about this paper that we've written and how what we're thinking. We've done a lot of work before on I suppose the again, coming back to these decisions that are made by often senior managers in prison organisations, and what's driving the digitization of our prisons. And Stephen and I have, I think we've been lucky enough to reflect on that and consider what we're calling the ethical principles for what we're calling, again, digital rehabilitation. So Stephen, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you, Victoria. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. I'm really happy that I can speak on this event. As Vic already introduced, we have been working for a long time already together on the context of digital and prisons, technology in prisons, in corrections in a broader sense. And today we would like to share some of ideas in the short time frame we have, some ideas and our thinking, what we did recently on the ethical principles and a framework of thinking around introducing technology in the correctional setting. So to start this, I would like to just shape a little bit the thinking process, give a short overview on the context and the framework wherein this digital change, in fact, is taking place. And would like to point out some moral drivers that are currently shaping our thinking on this. After this, Victoria will then describe some ethical principles we developed. We have detected those principles, and we believe that they could become pillars of an ethical framework, which could help policymakers, managers, technology designers, private companies, developers, practitioners, so everyone who's involved, and there are a lot of people involved in this, let me call it, technology-related journeys in prisons. Could you move to the next slide? Okay, perfect. Thank you. So when starting to reflect on the topic of technology and corrections, we were starting to think about a more generic standpoint and question ourselves, what is the thinking process behind using technology and corrections? Is it, why should we use technology and corrections? Is it good to use technology? Is it inevitable to use technology? Is there a kind of moral obligation around it? And maybe for some, this could be a kind of awkward question today if we see how digital our society has come. But when reading through many literature on technology in society or in corrections, many introductions begin with the premise that technology is rapidly changing, a fact that we can hardly deny, but immediately concludes with the consequence that we need to follow this evolution by adapting. My question is, the first question, should we just follow that change, and should we adopt, and should we start using technology in corrections, especially in prisons, which is still a specific situation? If we look on technology as such, the first reason we could think about is maybe just a pure instrumental one. If we believe technology can help us to improve the way we are doing our jobs, I think it's wise to carefully think how technology could help us and continues asking the question if it's helping us achieving our objectives. So the moral driver here of using technology is not technology as such, but it's more that we believe technology could help us doing a better job. But if you look a little bit further, I think we need to take some more distance about the pure instrumental view of technology and look at the broader picture. And that broader picture is not only looking at technology as a neutral instrument, but acknowledging that technology, as soon as we start implementing or using it somewhere, it's changing the environment. Technology is changing society. So it's much more than a simple tool, an instrument we use. It changes a lot. So the question around this is not as much about technology by itself. It's about that technology that changed society and changed our environment. And so we should turn and need to adapt to that new environment. And based on this, there are more fundamental drivers, moral drivers, we believe, that justify why we should adapt to technology in corrections some way or another. So first, if we have the ambition, if we believe that one of us raison d'etre in prisons is the rehabilitation of offenders, or maybe put this in the context of more recent assistant theories, if we want to create an environment where offenders can be motivated and prepared to return to life without crime, this environment should enable the preparation to return in a changing digital society. So we need to prepare offenders to return in that new normal. However, again, if we don't believe technology could help us doing this, so if we believe that we can develop digital skills and we can prepare offenders to return to society just by reading paper books and maybe giving PowerPoint presentations about how the internet looks like, we should not give them access to digital. And maybe this is a funny remark, but we see that this is a little bit the way what's happening in many prisons today. Many prisons, many correctional services desperately trying to kind of keep alive or even reanimate analog delivery models of services, where the outside, those delivery models don't exist any longer. So again, it's not a real obligation to use technology, but it's just like a smart way of doing is using technology to help people prepare for release. So the obligation to prepare offenders for release into a digital society does contain a kind of moral obligation. It doesn't tell us to give inmates a tablet or let them use the internet. It just tells us we need to find ways to prepare offenders to survive in this techie society. But it doesn't tell us how we could achieve this. Though I'm strongly convinced also this still omnipresent conservative attitude is far from normal. As a second moral driver, I strongly believe, and we strongly believe, that the principle of normality is really important here. It's really relevant in the context of the digital. I think the principle of normality is best known still by how it has been implemented in, for example, the Norwegian correctional system, and translated in how the most recent prisons in Norway and some other countries are designed currently, creating more human environments using colors and building materials we know outside. I think Halden Prison is very well known and even popular on Netflix, and pictures of their apartments instead of cells are shared all over the world. But the principle of normality is much more than just creating nice-looking prisons and jails. Implementing the principle of normality would imply clear and transparent arguments for every denial to offenders of any right other than the deprivation of liberty. It clearly states that the life in prison resembles life outside as much as possible. So this brings us much closer to the concept and the topic of today is human rights. The question of human rights in the context of the digital access in the prison has already emerged in legal proceedings recently. Legal cases labeled the reality of deprivation for serving prisoners, that they are actively denied access to information and services. Cases have been brought to court to determine the communicative rights of serving prisoners and the rights to access information. This is an ongoing debate in many Western countries already, and the European Court of Human Rights already has pronounced that the prison service needs to find solutions. They need to find solutions. It doesn't really say that they have to give inmates open internet access, but they need to give them a possibility to access digital content, to give them access to information that's currently only available anymore digitally, and also to access services like education, for example. A recent, court in Turkey obliged the Turkish Ministry of Justice to give an offender access to digital educational content. So in this context, it's also important to acknowledge the digital divide that origins from the deprivation to the digital and could be interpreted as a violence on the non-discrimination statement in the Human Rights Declaration. I'm not a legal expert, so maybe it's better not to stay a little bit in my comfort zone and just saying that it is just harmful to deprive people from communication and information technologies. A statement that probably has never been so clear as today during the COVID-19 crisis. And maybe at the end of this quick summary on moral drivers, is it just more and more evident that it's good, useful to introduce and add digital services into prisons? It is more and more proven to be helpful. A lot of fear is related to this topic. There are risks we will not deny. And a lot of technology has been brought into criminal justice, not only for the best reasons. We know that. IT can be a threat for human rights, privacy, dignity. And sometimes, unfortunately, this fear results in a very polarized discussion. Authors are writing about better than human. Is technology better than human? Is man better or machine? All those kinds of discussions, I think, are ridiculous. It's not or, it's and. We have to find balances. Technology has the power to make good things better, but also to make bad things worse. To help corrections avoid the latter, we have to start to develop a framework based on a set of ethical principles, we believe. And Victoria will tell you much more about those. Victoria, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Stephen. I always enjoy listening to you. I think it's worth sort of saying that how we've arrived at these moral drivers and ethical principles has come about as a result of scholarship, research, reviewing, I think, what others have said about the experience of prisons. We've drawn, and it's took me out of my comfort zone in terms of looking at computer ethics, stuff around computer science. So it's been an interesting journey. And so we've not just plucked these out of thin air. This has been years in the making. And as Stephen said, we feel that a kind of framework or a set of principles can be useful in helping prisons, particularly senior managers and developers, to make informed decisions about how they digitize the prison environment that we all know is fraught of issues of power and exploitation. And how then can technology be exploited to enable the humans within them to flourish? So taking the moral drivers, what we were then able to do was to develop a set of ethical principles. So these are just a guide that we think are some of the things that need to be addressed. So if we take the first one listed here, the legal principles, this relates directly to the moral driver on human rights. So it's ensuring that digitization is within the law. I mean, it speaks for itself. Stephen alluded to, you know, issues where prisoners brought prison services to court because they weren't getting access, for example. But also more broadly, and we're seeing more and more discussion in relation to analytics and artificial intelligence. And, you know, to what point do we allow the machine, the computer, to override decision makings when we know serving prisoners and released prisoners, people that are re-entering society, are subject to the scrutiny of the state. And all those concerns around artificial intelligence perhaps replacing some of those human processes within that. Well, what is the legal framework? Have legal frameworks been developed yet? So I think ensuring that whatever decisions are made, that they are within the sort of remit of the law, or do we need to, as Hildebrand has said, that, you know, laws now need to be rewritten as a result of, you know, smart technologies. The other one linking to human rights is privacy and transparency. And some of you from Europe will be aware of sort of GDPR principles, for example. And there's a danger that we know, certainly within the context of the criminal justice system, that there's a lot of data created about individuals. Who owns that data? How much data should be collected? What happens to that data once a prison sentence has been served? You know, will that come back to them in some other shape or form, for example? So this idea of understanding privacy, but also transparency, if we are going to be using artificial intelligence, for example, what data is fed into that machine or that program to make those decisions? You know, that must have come from human data. There's a human being at the end of that, and also at the other end of that. So these issues around privacy and transparency, I think, are linked to those moral debates about human rights. Normality, I think Stephen spoke quite vividly about that. Normality is about, for us, and others have said this, about positive outcomes by introducing normal access to goods and services. For example, people being able to make decisions about, you know, how to spend their money, for example, what jobs they can apply for, having normal conversations with their friends and family, be it in them in their cells or elsewhere. We've seen certainly within the context of the recent pandemic, you know, acceleration use of video calls, for example, as opposed to telephone calls, certainly within the UK, and I know also in Australia. So this idea of normality, but also the impact, there's a great piece of research by McDougall et al. Reporting on, you know, as an introduction of kiosks into prisons and reductions in incidents, and also reduction in recidivism rates as well. So there's something about that technology that is empowering prisoners to, you know, to make choices and take control of their own lives, rather than being subject to a very paternal model, for example. The next one on equality and fairness. Whenever you read a lot of literature about prisons, there's lots of discussion about trust and fairness. And we believe that this can apply to sort of the principles of digitization and reducing the limits of, or limiting deprivation. As we've seen, and Stephen's alluded to that earlier, around the digital divide and digital deprivation and the impact that that is having. I saw on the news this morning, you know, it's okay handing out computers to people, but if they can't afford the electricity bill to power it, for example. So it's a very holistic view. It's not just about the technology, it's not just about the software, but it's about enabling people to engage more prolifically on that. So enhancing equality and fairness is important. as I said at the beginning of the presentation, the digitization of our prisons isn't saturated in technology. There are pockets of that, and that is growing and swelling, and that's pleasing to see, particularly in the light of COVID. But prisoners don't have a choice where they end up in prison. So one prison may be, providing a good digital service, but they may well end up in another prison that doesn't. So how are central services or central jurisdictions responsible for prisons monitoring that and ensuring equality and fairness across the board? I think I've touched on proportionality, and again, this is about depriving prisoners, or not depriving prisoners any more than what they experience. And again, it's about what data should be collected. Why do we collect the data that we do? What's the use of that data? If we think about certainly what Ben Crewe's written about forms of soft power and the power that data can have on decision making for people within the criminal justice system as well. And it's a bit like, can that information come to bite you back? A bit like a credit file check. If any of you are familiar with that, with your finances, you see how credit worthy you are. This data can come back to bite you. So I think some deep considerations about data that is collected. Certainly now we're moving towards online platforms. So that, to me, in terms of ethics, is about consent. Are people consenting to something that they want to? Is there an option to opt out, for example? And the final point is about agency, and this links to the sort of moral driver of digitization, or opportunities to digitize, to be restorative, to lead towards rehabilitation rather than exacerbate or even eradicate forms of punishment and go towards the sort of rehabilitative. So notions of agency, and I think this is particularly highlighted when we think about education in prisons and where students in prisons can actually access information, for example, doing their own research. Is a walled garden, a closed intranet, sufficient for people to thrive and be autonomous, for example? So considerations for autonomy, I think, come within this notion of agency, and I'm sure you guys out there listening today, I'd look forward to your comments on some of the points that I've made. Just to conclude then, folks, because I'm really keen on discussion, is this notion of that what we want as a result of digitization. I think Stephen and I would agree that social agents, be them prisoners, staff, their families, the wider society, that agency flourishes, and that people have fair and equal access as much as possible, that data is protected and it's consensual, principles of normality, that digital is normal. Look at us here today. We're coping with this situation, and we're all sat here looking at each other on the screen for now. And I do look forward to the day to meeting face to face, and whether or not it's lawful. We hope that, and this has been a whistle-stop tour, and our work isn't finished on this, and we do welcome your thoughts and ideas. As I said, we're working on this global project at the moment around digital maturity. I'm thinking of developing some of these ethical principles around notions of desistance, and we're hoping to get some funding to do some work on that. There's lots and lots to say on this, really. What we've done on the PowerPoint, there's our details here, and we've listed the articles, I think, that have informed, I think, this body of work that we're doing around an ethical framework as well. So thanks so much to NCJ. I look forward to hearing what folks have got to say about what Stephen and I have got to have said. Stephen, have you got anything else to say before we hand back?
Oh, I have a lot to say, but I think we have to stick to the time. No, thank you very much, Victoria. I also would like to hear some feedback from other people.
Okay, so I think the that's a cue for the people around the round table to have an opportunity to comment. So if I say to the live audience out there on YouTube, if you'd like to use the chat line to send a question in, that's great. They will be passed to me as well. But in the first instance, let's look to people on the round table. Do you want to comment on what you've heard about these drivers and the ethical framework? Because these are really big issues. I have echoes of Big Brother in my head, and I'm wondering if you do too. So who would like to start off with a comment? Francis, you're waving your hand. Say say hello and then get your comment.
Yes. Sorry, Francis Toy. I'm the founder and CEO of Unilink, who do self-service in a few places around the world. And I just wanted to add briefly to the digital debate. I love my job because there's always massive demand for more digital in prisons. And that's because the starting point, to be frank, is it's a bit of a digital desert. And so there's huge demand, like for water in think about water in Sahara, more like that. And we're trying our very best to keep up with really what is massive demand for change. And the pace, so just got 2 points. One is the pace of technology outside is really hard to match within the prison setting. And we're doing our best to deliver some of those things. But that technology can really deliver education, growth for people, family communication, and real help to prisoners who get to learn more. The second thing I want to say, and this to prison authorities, is digitization can help you. It's not just for prisoners, it helps prison officers. It helps prison officers to be more effective. So if you can afford to make the investment in time looking at technology, it will pay off in the long term for you as well. So
thank you.
We'll carry on doing our best. That's my 2 points.
Excellent. Right, that's got the ball rolling. Who'd like to come next? Is anybody waving their hand to come next? Thank you. Milan Mareva, would you like to unmute yourself, please?
Yeah. Can you hear me now?
Yes, Milan.
So, hello, everyone. My name is Milan. I'm from the Czech Republic, and I've been working with the Czech Probation Service for 10 years now. And there's a question I'd like to ask related to digitalization in prisons. I think that it was Victoria who in her presentation mentioned that laws need to be rewritten in order to reach a certain level of digitalization, not only throughout the society, but in the prison environment as well. Now, my question is there any feedback on the attitude of policymakers in terms of digitalization in prisons? In other words, is there support on the side of policymakers to introduce or to accelerate digitalization through their policymaking? Is there any feedback on that?
Great question. So it's about the appetite for legal reform. So let's start with Victoria and maybe Stephen. Victoria first. Don't forget to unmute Victoria.
Hey. Hi again. Okay. Well, I'll refer to our current research on digital maturity. So what we're doing is we ran a global questionnaire, and that questionnaire was sent to those responsible for digitization at a very high level centrally in prison services. And we've got the responses back. And yes, of course, there is appetite. But it's interesting what the drivers are. And I think coming back to your point about laws is that there's a bit of, it's a bit of a minefield. It's what are prison services permitted to do within the law or to do within policy? And I think often policy can be quite fixed. And I've had lots of conversations with senior colleagues in prison services where they're sort of stuck with this policy, and that what's happening is that digitization means that policies often has to be redrafted. So I think what we're seeing is that they're very concerned about managing a particular strategy that's often part of a bigger service strategy, and some of that is stitched in throughout and some of it's siloed. It depends on the jurisdiction. It is a challenge, but I think what I'm saying is that sometimes and this is not a criticism, that looking outside at the wider implications of digitization in society sometimes haven't been picked up in those policies. So it is about, I think, paying attention and sometimes joining up work with those outside agencies to sort of inform digital development and digital strategy development. Stephen, you have definitely got some points to say here.
Yes. I have recently been looking very much into that concept of legal support for digitalization. And there are three things I would like to share. First of all, you see, and I think Victoria also a little bit mentioned about that in countries where the digital is high on the agenda of the government, you see there is much more support and drive to enter the digital also into the prison. That doesn't mean that digital is very quickly translated in a rehabilitation way of used for offenders, but it helps. And this is especially seen in Asian countries like Singapore, like Hong Kong and things like that. Another thing, and I think that's very relevant, and also because I see that Pia is also here on the call, is we have a very, I think, unique example in Europe where access to the digital and digital participation has been put in legislation, in the penal legislation, in Finland, for example. And that really helps, I think, drive. It gives you an obligation to invest in this because it becomes a legal obligation to access. But in fact, from a broader European legal perspective, we don't have to do that because a lot of lawyers everywhere, I heard today from a lawyer in France who's doing that. There is a famous politician in Germany, a lawyer who's really working on the legal access to the internet and made. So the European prison rules, the human rights already give a very, as I mentioned, framework that could help. But of course, if you translate it in local legislation, it helps, and there is a lot of examples already, and it's happening. Last thing, I see that the Belgian new Minister of Justice also put this in a new governmental agreement, that he really wants to work on that, give access to offenders. The same has happened in the Netherlands. So it's happening everywhere, and I hope this would help, and maybe link you already to some other examples in Europe and internationally.
Okay, now Rob Canton has raised his hand. So if you could unmute and make your comment or question, Rob. I've got four questions coming in from the YouTube audience, so we'll give them a chance as well. So first Rob, and then we'll do one or two from YouTube, and then I think Pedro wants to come in. It's pretty lively out there. Okay, Rob first.
Thank you, John. Very much appreciated. Hello, everyone. Good to see you all, and thank you very much to Victoria and Stephen for fascinating introductions to this topic. Great for me to see you beginning with ethics, or putting ethics straight in, because so often the criminal justice system proceeds with something and says, oh, does it work and is it any good, and then thinks, oh yes, And there's the ethics considerations, but you've put that in from the very start. So three cheers for that, and thank you. And I think that the starting point with human rights is fundamental, because this is not just about facilitating rehabilitation or even supporting resistance. It's fundamentally about making sure that people who are serving prison sentences have access to digital inclusion, have the same opportunities, that they are not further excluded from the world in which most other people live. And then my final point is just to ask whether anybody knows whether the Council of Europe prison rules has anything to say on this topic. Because if this is to go beyond an academic community of people who are already thinking along similar lines, it would be good if someone could at some point make representation to the Council of Europe and say, this is something that needs a recommendation, either a discrete one, or it needs some kind of emphasis in existing recommendations on either on prisons or community sanctions or measures or both. Because that way is the beginning towards a soft law and to making sure that legislation begins to reflect the modern world in which we live. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Rob. So I'll try and get two or three of the outside questions in now. One from someone called A. Sartorio. Thank you very much. It's a question for Victoria. Is there a current pilot project in the works to test or serve as a case study to implement some of the initiatives that you discussed?
Thank you for that question. That's an interesting question, and you've reminded me we've omitted in our presentation the sort of paucity of research evidence. There have been a small handful of, should I say, evaluations of technologies. More recently in England and Wales, there was an evaluation of in-cell telephony. And there's been, and I mentioned the McDougall study, which looked at some of those interesting outcomes that certainly prison services would be motivated to look at. There's several challenges with research in this area. As a researcher, and I don't want to get too technical about research methodologies, but because the pockets of, I suppose, research are relatively small, the kind of evidence base that services are often after isn't big enough to satisfy that need to say, well, does it work? What works? What works? The other issue is that they're quite geographically dispersed. So that presents challenges. Often that they are very small pilots that last for a small amount of time. This is, I'm talking historically here. But as we're seeing things grow, I think there's now is the time that we should be doing more of that kind of research. However, us researchers firstly need access. We need funding to do the research. And there needs to be a commitment and a partnership between, you know, academics, developers, prison services, that kind of thing. So it's been an interesting journey. And from my point of view, I'm interested in the human condition. And for you senior managers that are listening out there, I'm less concerned about, you know, KPIs. I'm more interested in what it's doing to the human and how much it's leading towards, you know, those softer things that we can't necessarily measure. So things like desistance rather than rehabilitation.
Okay. Yes. I'm going to pause you there because we're running out of time a bit. Yes. For this section. Pedro wanted to come in, and then I've got another question from YouTube. Pedro.
Well, hello, good morning to you all. Picking on what Francis started to mention and Stephen later on. Well, the I fully agree that there has been in many countries this has been quite a desert field in terms of digitization. Certainly, it has been, and technology has been bringing access to or allowing the access to basic rights of individuals, being in terms of communications, as Victoria just mentioned, visitation, health, learning. Access to other services that relate, for instance, with employment support or access to justice with virtual court hearings that we've been seeing increased all over the world. When we bring these services, and as it was mentioned as well, we see the huge potential for acquiring data about individuals, about their behaviors, about the way they live, the choices they make, the persons they relate to. And I just wanted to make the point about the legislation issue that you previously mentioned. So at the European level, that has been a big concern about this. So how to what extent can these data be used? To what extent can these data be used for other purposes, can be analyzed, and can be used to predict future behavior, for instance, in many cases? So the Council of Europe at the end of 2019 issued an European Ethical Charter on the use of artificial intelligence in judicial systems, which was quite a bold move, I must say. We're talking about it's a recommendation, of course, but it was approved by the Council of Ministers at the Council of Europe. So it's important enough, because it brings already recommendations about respect of fundamental rights, about the principle of non-discrimination, quality and security, transparency, user under control, and so on. So there are recommendations, and the principles are very important. And lately, we've seen as well the European Commission publishing both the European Parliament this year adopting a resolution about the use of artificial intelligence and how it's being used in the criminal justice sector, or the European Commission publishing guidelines for member states as well on that regard. So I know this, at least the last ones about the European Commission and the Parliament are a bit, we will not affect the UK at least, but the one from the Council of Europe or the recommendation is certainly valuable. So, but the point I want to make is that even though the national legislations may not refer specifically to this at European level and at these higher instances, let's say, that influence national legislation, there is already work being done that somehow influences the legislation at national level. Of course, at the level of the European Commission, we've seen what has been the impact of the GDPR as well, and other directives and regulations. So this is just to say that yes, there is a lot already being produced that will have an impact on national legislations that will affect the way we use digital technologies in prison.
Okay, wow. Pedro.
Thank you.
Thank you for that. One last point coming from our audience, if I may. This is from a guy called Yuri Myrtle. Thanks very much, Yuri. So it's to Stephen. You mentioned some positive examples of technology implementation, Norway, etc. Can you elaborate more examples, please? Because in Czech prisons, even Skype calls are sometimes a big problem. So just let's end with some positive examples and then we'll move on with our agenda.
Yes, okay, so positive examples. I think there's a lot of things coming on education for prisons. I think Sweden was one of the pioneers in using a Citrix-based system to support remote education. I think Denmark was one of the pioneers in access, giving MIDs access in specific areas in libraries, access to the internet. Norway, exactly, they are really going into an enormous digital stream, modernizing the entire digital infrastructure. What's very important in Norway is to see how this is part of the model, and they integrate or the entire staff. We already heard someone say, don't forget about the staff. The staff integrated in supporting that approaches towards individualized access to services. So that's a very good thing. I think Pia Puoloko is here, the project leader of the Digital Prison Project in Finland. They also delivered a journey for giving inmates access to the digital. When I was CIO in Belgium, we started the prison cloud system in the prison of Beveren, which was implementing a platform to enable the delivery of different digital services. What kind of digital services? Of course, educational, controlled access to the internet, but also communication, also access to legal files. I know there is a project going on in the UK to give inmates access to the legal files, mainly focused mm-hmm. on pretrial detention. I can go on and go on, so please reach out to me and I can share a lot. And this is only Europe, and I would be able to tell you a lot of other
Quite often, prison authorities are influenced about good examples from other jurisdictions. So let's get those in the public domain. Now, look how lively that was. I want to also remind everybody that if you want to carry on a conversation, apparently lots is happening on Twitter as well at the moment. So if you want to go to @INTCJNetwork, I cannot multitask. I'm a mere mail, so I'm concentrating on what's happening here. But out there in this Twitter sphere, apparently there's a conversation going on. Feel free, those of you that can operate on different levels, to do that. So we're going to go off from that discussion. Thank you for it, and also for Stephen and Victoria for starting us off so well. You have been listening to the INCJ podcast, conversations about international criminal justice. Find out more, go to our website at criminaljusticenetwork.net or follow us on Twitter @INTCJNetwork.